Thank the organizers of this conference for inviting me to talk about this topic, which is very dear to my heart. I know I'm talking to experts in the field, so I'm not going to be dwelling much on things that we already know, but I'd like to remind us about things that we frequently don't think about in terms of the problems that smokers are exposed to. Well, I'm going to be talking a little bit about passive smoking and present some of the data that you may or may not have had the time to look up. I'll be talking about a topic that is going to gain more momentum in the future, which is the relationship between smoking and breast cancer, especially since the demographic that seems to be gaining more in terms of smoking are young women who are exposing themselves, in addition to the usual hazards that we know about, to what I think is a significant risk of breast cancer. I will talk a little bit about surgery in smokers and what the data shows in terms of the importance of smoking cessation and the timing of smoking cessation. If I have time, I will be also talking about inhalational drugs and how they are influenced by smoking. And I may spend some time talking about argiri smoking if time permits. So I'm not going to be talking about these issues here, although I'd like to just remind us about some of the newer data that apply to what we know about the complications related to smoking in the area of coronary artery disease, peripheral vascular disease, COPD, lung cancer, bladder cancer, head and neck cancer, and esophageal cancer. So in terms of coronary artery disease, we are all familiar with the relationship between smoking and coronary artery disease. However, I'd like to remind especially the women smokers that exposure to tobacco smoke exposes women to a significantly higher risk of coronary artery disease than men. And you will notice in this British Medical Journal article that at every level of smoking, the complications, coronary artery disease and myocardial infarction related to smoking is significantly higher in women than in men. And only in ex-smokers and never smokers is the risk comparable. These are people who otherwise have the same kind of, who have been controlled for other variables. In terms of peripheral vascular disease, To be fair to men, let's also talk about erectile dysfunction, which has been reported to be significantly increased in smokers. And if you look at these numbers here, you would see that the risk of erectile dysfunction seems to be linked to the degree of smoking. The higher the smoking, the more the risk of developing erectile dysfunction, even if we correct for age and for duration of smoking. In terms of COPD, the common teaching is that smoking is only perhaps 15 to 20% of smokers develop COPD. And more recent data suggests that, in fact, the incidence is much higher depending on what parameter you look at. So if you only look at PFT data and FEV1, the incidence of COPD in smokers is around 15 to 20%, but if you look at other variables, you're going to find, this is what this shows in terms of PFTs. But if you look at other variables like symptoms, like the presence of cough, like the use of medications, you would see that the proportion of people who smoke, who need COPD drugs and who have symptoms related to COPD is much higher, and it's in the range of 50 to 80%. So the common argument that not all smokers develop COPD and only a small minority develop COPD is probably erroneous, and the incidence is much higher than we have thought in the past as 15 to 20%. In terms of lung cancer, there's not much new here other than to show you that 90% of lung cancers are related to smoking. This is something that you know. But more importantly, it's the risk of cancer is related to the duration of smoking and also to the intensity of smoking. And when people smoke a lot for a long period of time, the risk of cancer becomes up in the 40 to 50%. So again, the teaching is that only 15 to 20% of smokers develop lung cancer, but this is really an understatement because those who smoke significantly, like these people with 40 to 50 pack years who have smoked for a long period of time, these are people who are going to have a significantly higher incidence of lung cancer. Bladder cancer, again, is related to smokers. It is said that around 50% of bladder cancer is related to smoking. And here, again, is an area where women need to be aware, because whereas the risk of developing bladder cancer is increased in male smokers, it's increased much more in female smokers, and female smokers appear to have a much higher incidence of bladder cancer than male smokers. The last two categories, head and neck cancer and esophageal cancer, I only want to remind people that it's not only the intensity and duration of smoking that's related to oral cancer and esophageal cancer, but it's also the coexistent abuse of alcohol. So people who abuse, who consume a lot of alcohol in the setting of continued smoking are going to have a higher incidence of oral cancer and esophageal cancer. So I'm going to skip these. Okay, let's talk a little bit about passive smoking, secondhand smoking, and I'm going to be talking about the risks for both children as well as adults. In children, the syndromes associated with passive smoking include SIDS, chronic respiratory diseases, asthma, reduced lung function growth, and middle ear infection diseases. I'm only going to be talking about SIDS and lung growth. So what do we know about the relationship between smoking and sudden infant death syndrome? These studies are old. There have been very few recent studies on the SIDS in smokers and in passive smoking. This is a study from 1991 in New Zealand, which shows that the relationship between SIDS and smoking is actually dose dependent. This is maternal smoking, so these are women who smoke during the last 2 weeks before delivery, and this is their frequency of smoking, and you will notice that the higher the incidence, the intensity of smoking, the higher the incidence of SIDS in their children and their neonates. And this has been confirmed in many other studies. This is another study in 1995 that shows that the relationship between SIDS and smoking increases if the number of smokers in the house increases and also if the intensity of smoking is higher. This is a meta-analysis that shows that the in terms of maternal smoking, whether we're talking about prenatal or postnatal maternal smoking, the incidence of SIDS is higher. So I think this is another one that says the same thing. But it also applies to male smokers. So men, fathers are equally guilty in terms of exposing their neonates to the hazard of SID. And this meta-analysis shows that, in general, paternal smoking does increase the risk of SIDS in their children. The other thing relating to, and I'm not a pediatrician, so I'm only going to tackle a couple of issues related to smoking hazards in children. How about lung growth in children who are exposed to tobacco smoke in their early years of their life? You all know that lung growth does not stop at birth. The lungs continue to grow, and growth continues throughout adolescence, and most people's lungs continue to grow up till probably the early 20s. And in the early childhood, lung development comes to completion with formation of alveoli, but lung function growth patterns change in height. So as long as people are growing in height, their lungs are increasing in size. Small secondhand smoke increases the risk of respiratory infections. We're not going to address these. But there is stunting of lung growth, and reduction in lung function is observed in children who are born to active smokers, and this continues to be a problem throughout the early formative years of their lives. So here, this is a study done in Boston that looked at smokers versus women who don't smoke significantly versus women who smoke a significant amount of tobacco. And you'll see that lung function is related to lung growth is stunted in proportion to the amount of smoking that the mothers display. This was shown in another study by Harvard that was done in six cities that showed that there is small reduction in lung function through adolescents associated with both current and preschool exposure to maternal smoking, and that early childhood exposure appears to exert long-lasting effects on lung maturation. Studies in adults have also shown that there is a reduction in lung function with continued smoking, and you're all aware of that. So this is just a reminder that children are affected by exposure to secondhand smoke. They're affected in the early years, neonatal years, with increased incidence of SIDS. They're also affected in their formative years, in adolescence and early childhood, with a reduction in lung growth. And these have long-term complications manifesting as recurrent infections, possibly development of asthma, which I'm not going to go into. What about adults? The health effects of adults, I've started this lecture by talking about what we already know, but I'm going to be addressing other things that people do not pay a lot of attention to, including the controversial issue of breast cancer. So what do we know about smoking and breast cancer? Some of the data here is old, and some is relatively new. So in this meta-analysis that looked at the incidence of breast cancer in women who smoke, comparing premenopausal and postmenopausal, you would see that there is an increase in the incidence of breast cancer in all women, but more so in premenopausal younger women. And when you look at passive smoking versus active smoking, you're going to find very similar patterns. So exposure of women, especially premenopausal women, to tobacco smoke, whether through active smoking or through passive smoking, appears to be linked to breast cancer. This is a more recent study from 2013 that looks at these issues, at the incidence of breast cancer in women. And if you look at this data, you're going to show that there is an increase in breast cancer, which is related to the age at which women start smoking. So the younger they start smoking, the more the incidence of breast cancer. Even those who do not start smoking early but start smoking before the birth of their first child appear to have a higher incidence of breast cancer. And this is shown more dramatically here by a meta-analysis that shows that even when they stop smoking, the incidence of breast cancer continues to be significantly higher in women who were exposed to tobacco smoke. And as I said, this is related to the age at which they start smoking. You'll see that most of these show that the curve is shifted to the right, and those who smoke start smoking before the birth of their first child. What about surgical risk? This is controversial. More recent data do not agree fully with what I'm going to say, although data still shows that the duration, the timing of cessation of smoking is important in terms of the development of post-operative complications. And maybe Dr. Khayat will comment on this in his presentation. So what is the effect of smoking cessation on complications? And you will see that whenever people stop smoking before surgery, there is an improvement in outcome. And here you see that the curve shows that intervention here is smoking cessation. You're going to find an improvement in post-operative complications. These are atelectasis, infections, and pneumothorax. If you look at the timing of the cessation of smoking, And you will find that many studies show data similar to this, which is you really need to have stopped smoking for a significant period of time before surgery so that you avoid the postoperative complications. So in this study, people who stopped smoking for at least 8 weeks before scheduled surgery, the pulmonary complications were significantly reduced to a level very close to non-smokers, while those who never stopped smoking or stopped smoking for periods less than 8 weeks, they still had a significant number of postoperative complications. This is also true when the surgery is done in the thorax in terms of resectional lung surgery. And here you see that when smoking cessation occurred for at least 4 weeks before the procedure, before lung resection, the complications were significantly less than those in whom the smoking cessation occurred for periods less than 4 weeks. So this shows this a little more in a more detailed manner, looking at week by week, and you will find that once you get to lower levels here, between 8 to 12 weeks, this is when you get the most significant reduction in postoperative complications. More recent data shows the same in terms of the risk of complications. And again, these studies from 2012 show that a significant degree, a significant time must elapse before surgery is performed to allow smoking cessation to have a positive impact on the outcome of the surgery and the postoperative complications. This applies also to wound healing, so this is not only in terms of respiratory complications, other complications like the degree of wound healing and the lack of wound dehiscence is related to the duration of smoking cessation. As I said, more recent data shows that this may not be true everywhere, although the data is controversial and studies from the last 2 years show both ends of the spectrum. So this is an area that we probably need to watch in the next few years. A lot of medications are now given by inhalation. This is a short list of medications that may be given through the inhalation route. And people are starting to wonder whether smokers, by virtue of having alveolar damage, may have a different pattern of absorption and a different pharmacology of these medications that are given by inhalation. The data, the most significant data that is now very timely is inhaled insulin. And studies have shown that actually the pattern of absorption of inhaled insulin is different in smokers than in non-smokers. And if you look at, in this study, if you look at the area under the curve, or you look at the concentration of insulin after inhalation, you would find that smokers actually have a significantly lower, the absorption is much higher in those who are smokers, indicating that the effect may be faster and people may actually have problems with glucose control if they continue to inhale, to smoke during the use of these inhalational drugs. It is possible that this may be an acute effect rather than a chronic effect. It may be related to the acute inhalation of gases, of smoke, rather than alveolar damage. So more studies are needed in this area, but this is an area of growth, and people are looking at this more carefully. So what happens if you stop smoking? So those individuals who actually stopped smoking for a period of time, for a few weeks before they were tested again, show a reversal of the problems related to the absorption of insulin through the inhalation route. So this is showing it in a different manner. What about the argili or the hookah, Dr. Yusser's favorite topic? So this is an area that's really controversial, and the quality of the data that's published is still not very good. There is a lot of work that's being done, and you will find a lot of conflicting data when you review the literature. But it appears that there is a consensus now that Argili smokers have the same kind of complications that cigarette smokers have. And so comparison of pulmonary function, respiratory symptoms in water pipe and cigarette smokers, this is a recent study that compared Argili smokers, water pipe smokers, with cigarette smokers with deep inhalation versus cigarette smokers with not so deep inhalation. And if you look at every parameter of symptomatology that was looked at, whether it's wheezing, whether it's chest tightness, cough, or sputum production, you will find that the data shows that Argili smokers have pretty much the same rate of complications as people who inhale cigarette smokes cigarettes very deeply. So the pattern of symptomatology, at least, in water pipe or hookah smokers is very similar to cigarette smokers with deep inhalation. If you look at PFTs in these individuals, not only symptoms, you will find again that if you look at each of these parameters, you will find that the numbers in water pipe smokers parallel very much the numbers in cigarette smokers with deep inhalation and are worse than cigarette smokers who do not inhale deeply. Looking at other complications related to smoking, looking here at lung cancer, you will find that in this study published in 2010, this is a meta-analysis of a number of studies that looked at lung cancer in hookah smokers and water pipe smokers, and you will see that in each of these studies, the incidence of lung cancer is higher in hookah smokers. And this is looking at low birth weight, and you'll find that it's exactly the same thing with in each study that looked at these parameters, this meta-analysis that shows that hookah smokers have the same rate of complications as cigarette smokers. CDC has recently published their recommendations regarding hookah smokers or water pipe smokers and compared hookah smoking to cigarette smoking. And they say that water pipe smoking delivers nicotine in at least as much concentrations as cigarette smoking. And because of the mode of smoking, the frequency of puffing, the depth of the inhalation, the length of the session, probably the exposure is much higher than cigarette smoking. They make this statement, which many people dispute, but I like to use it when I try to scare people. It's that 1 hour of hookah smoking, one head, is the equivalent of between 100 and 200 cigarettes. And this is probably true in terms of the amount of smoke that's generated in one sitting. And this is what we've already talked about in terms of the risks of exposure. So I want to also spend some time talking about what's called third-hand smoking, which I think is relevant in Argili smokers because of the intensity of smoke that's generated during Argili smoking. So this is a new concept that we may or may not be aware of, or we may not be giving this a lot of attention. So third-hand smoking, in contradistinction to second-hand smoking is exposure to smoke that's emanating from the cigarette or the Argili. But the third-hand smoking is residual tobacco smoke pollutants that remain on surfaces or in dust after tobacco has been smoked and are re-emitted into the gas phase or react with oxidants and other compounds in the environment due to secondary pollutants, some not found in the original smoke that was generated by the burning tobacco. And this is a new topic that warrants our attention. We don't know much about the nature of these chemicals. Some studies have compared secondhand smoke with third-hand smoke, and they found that there is a different time profile of exposure. With third-hand smoking, you're really exposed all the time, depending on you live in a house that is really infested with residues or cars that are infested with residues. The concentrations may be different. They may be less in third-hand smoking. We don't know. There are newer pollutants that we have not recognized in total, although some studies have published newer chemicals that are released by third-hand smoking. And we don't know whether dermal and inhalational routes have equivalent degrees of damage. So this is something that warrants future research, and I'm sure many of us may be interested in studying that, especially in Argeli smoking because of the intensity of smoke that's generated. So health risks of third-hand smoking may include some of those risks of second-hand smoking, but there may be other ones that we don't know yet that may not be directly related to tobacco but may reflect the interaction between residues and environmental factors. And this is the impetus in the United States for creating completely smoke-free environment and complete bans in hotels and rental cars. And now there is a movement actually to ban smoking in your own home because you are exposing children and visitors not only to smoke during the act of smoking, but also during periods of time when people are exposed to third-hand smoke. So I had a number of questions, but my time is up, so we're going to post all these slides as well as a number of questions and answers that tend to emphasize the points that I've made, and these will be available on the website. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Dr. Babo, for this interesting highlights on unusual aspect of smoking problems. And I think there are many, many questions on the floor. We have time for 3 or 4 questions. Microphone, please. Please, microphone.
Thank you for this comprehensive presentation. I would like to ask you, what do you think about long-term oxygen therapy and smoking?
Long-term what?
Oxygen therapy at home and smoking.
Okay, so home O2 therapy is a recognized therapy for those with advanced COPD. The criteria for administering, for prescribing home oxygen are very much defined. Home O2 is one of few therapeutic modalities that are known to be associated with prolongation of life. So in addition to smoking cessation, which is one factor we know does prolong life, administration of oxygen as a therapeutic agent for those who need it and those who have a PO2 that's less than 55 or a saturation less than 88% at rest or with exercise, this is known to prolong life.
A risk. There is a risk of explosion with those who continue to smoke with the oxygen.
So this is an ethical issue that we deal with every day. And because of what I just said about the fact that this is a modality that's known to prolong life, at least in the U.S., we are prohibited from withholding oxygen because of the risk of explosion. And what we have to do is to educate people. Yes. And hope for the best.
Dr. Wackett?
So you're talking about the development
of oxygen. You're talking about development of oxygen-free radicals during oxygen. Yeah. So this is a potential complication when you are delivering oxygen in the setting of also inhalation of oxidizing agents, you are transforming oxygen into free radicals. It's a theoretical consideration. I'm not aware of studies that show that that is a reality, but it is a potential complication.
There are questions. Yes, sir. Thank you.
I'm Dr. Bukai from Jordan. Actually, I have a few comments. One of them is we have a study at King Hussein Medical Center in Amman, Jordan, and unfortunately, the percentage of doctors smoke, very, very sorry, 50%. Imagine 50% of the doctors are smokers. So that's very, very, very bad issue. This is number one. Number two, actually, I like what happened with the Islamic Hospital. In the Islamic Hospital, anybody who smokes and he is employed at the Islamic Hospital, he will be dismissed immediately. I like this issue. Number three, I would like to speak with everybody with his, either if he is a religious man, I'd like to speak with him religiously. If he is an educated man, I'd like to speak with him from medical point of view. So we have to speak with everybody according to what he knows. So take Sheikh, for example, tell him Quran, what's said, he will be annoyed. If he is unsheikh, tell him what's going on with cancer, he will be annoyed. The third thing, that to stop opium is easier than to stop tobacco, believe me or not.
We're going to hear about this in the next slide. Sure. You know, I want to comment on the second point that you made, which is the
and you
filing.
Will be, the last point or comment, you would be very surprised if you look at the packet itself, the packet of smoking. It is written very clear, tobacco kills. Yeah. Tobacco has four components, nicotine number one, carbon monoxide number two, and qatran and tar number three. Smokers know that smoking kills. But what happened, that there is some psychological problem with the smokers. Yeah. I think that every smoker needs psychological support, because he is a sick man. Yeah. He needs support. He should go immediately to the psychiatrist to help him. Otherwise, he will not be, he will not stop smoking. And one thing which I would like to tell everybody, that if we can prevent smoking from the school at the beginning, not when he is having to been smoking for about 10 or 20 years.
Thank you.
This is a hopeless man. But when you talk with a child or whatever, he is undergraduate, it is very easy. He is like Ajinia. You can talk with him as much as you can. So these are my comments.
This is all smoking cessation policy, from childhood to smoking cessation treatment and treatment of all addiction, kind of addiction for smoking. Dr. Wackett, you have something to
say? Yes, actually it's a comment. Thank you very much. But I do not agree with the CDC recommendation, and some statements are definitely has been criticized widely in the literature. So I would have liked you to show the meta-analysis, a very recent one in 2012 in CHEST, showing a little bit what are the problems in methodology when you approach the water pipe smoking effect, because we are one of the really rare people here with Dr. Owen here in the moderators, among the moderators, who really did real life studies on water pipe effect. So it is a little bit, it's a lot of criticism about, you know, the equivalence between one puff of water pipe to 100 cigarettes.
One last question.
Yes. Do you have any? We know how we quantify our smoking for the patients who smoke cigarettes. Are there any new recommendations to quantify when they are smoking nargile, as we are talking about, pack years, or how are we quantifying? How we say? How can we?
Well, the way nargile is quantified is by the RAS nargile one head. I don't know if that's a standardized, but you seem to have an answer.
In fact, we developed a score like the Fagenstrom score for cigarette dependence. We developed a score, the Lebanese score for water pipe dependence. And the quantification that could be standardized is the number of water pipe smoked by week of smoking, by years of smoking. So not by day like in the cigarettes. It's how much the people are smoking water pipe per week, per year of smoking times. And this is a way to standardize the quantification.
Okay. Thank you. We have some copies of this article on the anti-smoking stand. You can take them if